our family's seed business. I was asked to go along through the Fertilizer and Chemical Association. And we went to the Soviet Union. It was still the Soviet Union in 1990, and then also to Poland. And one of the really hard parts of the whole 20-day trip was that I was a roommate with Doug Cooper. Now, trying to keep track of Doug Cooper for 20 days is not, Quinn, you know, right? We all share Doug Cooper stories. But on that trip, we were able to go out in the countryside in the Soviet Union and to see what central planning from Moscow did to the people out there, to their lack of productivity, for their even caring about producing, because they got no benefit themselves. As we also went to Poland, and we visited a farm family there where the grandfather had just gotten his land back from the Russians. He was standing there in tears with his son and grandson. He thought he would never see again or have the opportunity for ownership of that land. To see what governments can do to people, to individuals, to the ability for them to be successful, for them to have the kind of freedom in life that we enjoy here in this country. And that was one of the concerns I had when I saw what was happening in our family business. We were dealing with a regulation. We had in the seed business unloading a wagon of soybeans, and we had to find out how much dust would go off of that wagon load if, in fact, that wagon were unloading for 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Quite honestly, folks, that's not that big a wagon. It certainly would not take that long. But that was the kind of crazy things that I saw happening. And that's really what motivated me to get involved in politics, because I could see the effects of government. And 20 years later, it's getting, I think, even greater today, the effect than ever before. I'm really supposed to talk about what effect the government will have for the next 10 years with the regulations, all those things. But I think it's very important to kind of look back and see what has transpired recently. What's the current status of agriculture? We're in a time of great prosperity. Land values like we've never seen before, equity in agriculture, high prices, record high prices over the years that have led to this. It's just an incredible situation, and farmers really almost became embarrassed. And we saw what their ideas going forward with the next farm bill, the last farm bill, were because of that. There is tremendous equity, there's tremendous wealth in agriculture. And we bucked the rest of the economy. In Iowa, we never had the downturn because of agriculture that the rest of the country had. It is really an amazing thing to see, but also along with that came a lot higher input costs, whether you talk about seed, like my family's in the seed business, when you talk about fertilizer, pesticides, new innovations, all of those things become more and more expensive, or have become. Also seeing a transition because of the high cost of today's producer is a professional. They're a business person. It's not that the farmer can't survive today if he is not attuned to what's going on in the world. And I really believe that that is a major, major change from the farmers. Sometimes I saw neighbors growing up that really were not very good at it. You can't be not very good at it today and survive. So what are the challenges, I think, going forward in the next 10 years? What's the effect of government? I think there's a lot of things that we could talk about today, but just a few of them. The potential for lower commodity prices, tax policy that's going to hopefully take place, changes in technology, government regulations, food policy, trade, what happens with the U.S. budget, and what happens, I think, with the relationship today of agriculture with the Congress. some real challenges that we have going forward. As far as commodity prices, I think we all know the USDA has come out with projections that say that we're going to be at current levels or lower over the next 10 years. The effect that that's going to have as far as land values, and it's been incredible. My mother unfortunately passed away about a year ago. We had an estate sale, $11,500 an acre for that farm. Even back in the peak of the early 80s, it wasn't ever $3,000 an acre in that region. The rents, what the effect that's going to have as far as lower commodity prices, we're not going to have the bidding wars, the auctions for rents that are up to $400, $500, $600 an acre. What happens with the ability for farmers to purchase new equipment, to buy new technology that they're going to need to be successful in a more competitive environment? Tax reform. There's all kinds of talk in Washington. You've heard it about reforming the tax code so that we can be fair to everyone, make it simpler so that we can be competitive around the world, the businesses. There's some real concerns and doing away with the loopholes. Okay, well, one of those loopholes happens to be depreciation of equipment, bonus depreciation, things like that for in agriculture. What effect does that have with the ability of the farmer, lower prices, less income, to be able to purchase new equipment? You're going to see also the proposal about being more competitive. Corporations, the Chapter C corporations, at lowering their rate down to 25%. Excuse me, I'm battling a cold, too, even though I've been in Florida for 2 months. But anyway, you're going to see a real problem, I think, competitiveness in agriculture. Most farm operations are subchapter S's. They pay the tax rate at the current individual rate, which could be up to 39.5%. If, in fact, you have corporations paying 25% in Chapter C, there's going to be a real push for farmers to convert. The conversion itself is a taxable event. And that's going to cause, I think, a stretch as far as liquidity in agriculture, if in fact that takes place. The president has made a proposal as far as changing the stepped-up basis as far as inheritance to do away with that. This is his equity thing, transfer of wealth from the rich to basically to more government spending, but that's what he wants to do. What that will do is cause the heir to have the land valued that it was, you know, $12,000, $11,500, to go back to whatever grandma bought it at $200 an acre. Then if he were to sell it, he would have an enormous capital gains tax loss. What does that do to the value of the land itself? And what actions does the farmer himself take? I think there's some real concerns as far as changing the tax code and how it affects it in agriculture. In technology, my brother Don is all he does is farm now. He's out of the seed business. He's had GPS now for, 16 years. He's in map fields all that time. He's got all of this good information out there. He doesn't even today have to put his hand on the steering wheel in the combine or the tractor, which is good because his rows were always crooked anyway. But but technology like that is old hat today. What we're going to see in the future, and the folks at Bayer can tell you, is that you're going to have advanced technologies, sensing monitors on each and every field that'll tell you exactly what rainfall there was, what the temperatures have been, if there's an infestation of bugs or aphids or something like that coming into the field. All of these new technologies are going to be great, and you'll get a daily report on it. We're going to have drones out there flying around doing, you know, field monitoring. We have some of that already, but it's going to be very, very broad as far as use. We're going to have vast amounts of information in agriculture. I think some real questions in the government is going to have to, Congress is going to have to look at, is what about the privacy of all this information? Who has access to it? How can it be used? Whether you talk about corporations that will use it to their advantage, whether you talk about competitors overseas, all of the information that's available. What about our very own government? And what are they going to do with all the information that is being accumulated today? I think there's some real challenges out there. And also, I think for the individual producer, he's going to have access to all this information. The question is, what the heck does he do with it all? How do you put it into a plan so that it actually helps you be more efficient, to be more productive? Putting all this information, I think, is going to be one of the great challenges that we have in the future, certainly in agriculture. Regulations are something that I have seen grow and grow and grow. And in Washington, we obviously have real concerns in agriculture about the EPA, what their expansion of the interpretation of the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, those things that they can use to have, since many of them have an agenda in those agencies, can be used to go against what we believe it should be, the true interpretation of the laws itself. When you look at clean air, the particulates, and what that does, if you're a farmer at Alexander, Iowa, there's still gravel roads around there. You drive down, there's dust comes off the road. Now, is that going to be monitored? Are you going to be charged against that? Are you going to be able to harvest a crop that is dry and ready for harvest because of the dust coming off of that? The Clean Water Act, the rules that they're talking about with the waterways of the U.S., to regulate every puddle and every driveway in the country. And what you're going to see that, if in fact is put in place, is the smaller, especially livestock producers, are not going to be able to comply with those regulations. It's going to cause more consolidation, I believe, in agriculture, certainly in the livestock industry. We have the good folks with our animal rights. When we look at the new proposals as far as gestation for sows, cage sizes for chickens, all these things, what we've got to have, in my mind, is a federal policy by Congress that talks so that we have standards nationwide. There's a story I like to tell about, you know, our good farmers come into my office. They're with a group of egg producers. Their policy for their organization is that they want to go to the larger cages for chickens. So that's more humane, supposedly, when they lay their eggs. Okay, fine. So they make their case. Individually, as people are walking out of my office, every farmer there came up and said, that's the policy agreement, but don't do it. Please don't do this to us, what we just asked for. How do you represent people when there's no consensus in agriculture? The most frustrating thing I've ever had was to try and represent organizations who always change their policies. You can't do it. You have to have one voice and have a consistent message out there. We've got to have, I think, federal regulation to make sure that we don't have these hodgepodge of state regulations out there that some states, such as California, are using to prohibit trade from Iowa eggs going into California. To me, it's unconstitutional as far as access to those markets. The result, again, I think, is going to be consolidation in agriculture if, in fact, a lot of these regulations are allowed to go forward. We've got to have a functioning Congress to be able to address some of these issues, and that's really one of the big problems. As far as food policy, I think we've got a proposal from the administration talking about a single food safety agency in this budget this year. What does that mean to us? Does that mean that the There's cases, and there may be some justification for it. I mean, you've got cases like a pizza is always a good example, where the pepperoni is regulated or inspected by the USDA. The tomato sauce and the cheese is FDA. Why is that? Is there no consistency? Maybe there's an argument, but the devil is in the details. And when we see a proposal like that, it always makes me very, very concerned that you're going to have activists actually writing the rules. They're going to be much more restrictive. It's going to make food much more expensive. So I think any kind of proposal like that, while there may be some merit to it, I think we've got to be very, very careful. Excuse me. One of the big issues that I was talked to many, many times is genetically modified organisms. It is something that's going to be the issue, I think, for years and years to come. We see these state battles going on, the initiatives that we have, say, in the state of Washington last year that was barely defeated. Remember, I'm from the state of Iowa, and I think you had Norman Borlaug's, granddaughter here last year to visit about this. I'm the one who's, had the bill to give Norman Borlaug the Congressional Gold Medal, and I worked very, very hard that his statue now represents Iowa in Statuary Hall. So you might know where I'm coming from on this issue. Food, genetically modified organisms are safe. There is no debate in science. Even the Europeans who use it as a non-tariff trade barrier, their scientists say that it's safe. But what we've got to have is the public acceptance of it. We also have to have a national, Congress has to act to have a national policy where you can't have states having different policies out there. Because if not, we're going to have much more expensive food. Food companies are going to reformulate their ingredients. We're going to be tagged with a bad thing, crossbars, skeleton, whatever, with GMO products. It is simply wrong. It is safe. We've got to make sure that we push for Congress to actually act. I don't know how, with all the other issues, that things like this are going to be addressed, but that is really what needs to be done. One thing I would have to respectfully disagree with Jim this morning. There is a war on agriculture, on production agriculture. And I think the activists who spoke said that. It's not on our side. It's on their side. They have declared war on the ability for us to feed a growing population in this world and to do it without technology, without changing such things such as GMOs. That is going to be impossible when you have populations currently at, 7 billion, probably by 2050, 9.5 to 10 billion people. It simply needs to be done. And I really think that there is a concerted effort, and I don't know what the agenda is other than, like they mentioned, going back with a mule-drawn plow or something and trying to produce food for a world that's growing and growing and growing. Country of origin labeling, everybody knows that the World Trade Organization has spoken that we have to do something. Congress has to act either to repeal it or to change the rules where they're acceptable. To me, this is something that should have never been put in place in the first place because, again, it's not a food safety issue, but Congress is going to need to act. It's going to affect our ability, I think, to keep our trading partners, which Canada and Mexico are both our largest, to keep them involved in a good relationship with the United States itself. If there was some benefit to it, people should be able to label wherever the product came from. If they don't want to, it's not a food safety issue, so I don't believe they should. Trade is something that is going to be a major challenge for us in the next few years. The president has asked for trade promotion authority. He needs to push it very, very hard. He's got a bunch of union Democrats in Congress that will never support it. He's got a bunch of Republicans who don't trust this president for anything, who won't support it. But he's got to push pro-business Democrats, try to get enough Republicans so that he can get fast-track trade promotion authority. Because these trade deals that we have pending, certainly the Trans-Pacific partnership is something that would be of huge benefit to us. I was in Vietnam last May. For them, it's a national security issue for us to have trade and have access there because China is dominating the region. When you have a Chinese ship sitting offshore, that is a real threat to those folks. The way that that Chinese ship is not going to be a threat is if there's U.S. trade in the area. So it's going to be great for us. It's going to be a national security issue for them, something to be very, very positive. But there's a lot of people in Congress today who just cannot go along with free and fair trade. It's got to be free, fair, and trade that actually works for both sides. Just a couple things in closing. And I've been told that the most dangerous place to be at this time is between a bunch of ag journalists and happy hour, so we'll be quick. But the fact of the matter is, we're going to have real challenges budget-wise. We've got $18 trillion in debt, deficits close to $500 billion. That's down, but it's still outrageously high. What is that going to do long-term as far as interest rates? Janet Yellen today testified saying that they're on the verge of raising interest rates. We have about $250 billion a year in interest payments. What happens when that gets back to traditionally a national average interest rates or historic national interest rates? What that's going to do to the budget is going to blow it every year going forward. What we're seeing in Congress, and there's they want to reopen the farm bill for budgetary reasons, especially on crop insurance. This cannot happen. We've got to let the farm bill work, and I think we've got to have a strong voice saying that's not the way to go, that we've got to make sure that we are smart, allow the farm bill to work itself, and I think you folks can help us a great deal on that. Just in closing, I'll just say, 20 years ago, when I first went to Congress, we had, I think, a strong base of folks in Congress who represented ag districts, who had some type of working knowledge of production agriculture. It's not the case today. Even on the Ag Committee, you've got a group of people who are there for the nutrition portion of the farm bill, and you have a group of people, Republicans generally, that are there to cut spending on nutrition programs or anything else. Iowa last time went from 5 representatives to 4 representatives. We have fewer voices that understand anything about agriculture. I think that is going to be the greatest challenge we have going forward as people who believe and love agriculture, is that we no longer have a voice. We have got to tell our producers out there, you folks can do such a great job of getting the message out of how important it is that we have policies in place that help us, that actually allow us to provide that abundant, safe food for a growing world population. But we don't have the voices in the House of Representatives. We have folks today representing ag districts who will vote against agriculture for budgetary reasons or because some crazy outfit is scoring their vote. Rather than represent their constituents, they're representing those groups. It is a huge change. And when you talk to your farmers, they've got to know that they've got to get the message to Washington. They've got to bring this issue to the top. And don't just go there once if you're with the Soybean Association and think that you took a trip to Washington and they heard the message. Because a lot of times you're talking to a 23-year-old staffer that has no idea what you're talking about, and as soon as you leave the office, they forget about what you said. You've got to keep it in the forefront, let them know how important production agriculture is, the challenges that we face. I think it's going to be very difficult and challenging in the next 10 years. And the biggest problem we're going to have is in Congress to really adapt and to address the issues that are important to us. So with that, I thank you very much. And Frank?
Thank you. Well, thank you, sir.
You're welcome.
And we will be brief here, and I also want to open it up to the floor. I really want to start right actually where you stop with the remarkable comment, fewer voices that understand anything about agriculture in the Congress.
Absolutely.
It parallels the conversation about just fewer and fewer people who are involved in this. What's the impact, though? What is the implication going forward?
I think the impact is certainly going to be a lack of addressing issues that are important to production agriculture. When they talk about reopening the farm bill, there's going to be people on both sides that are going to be very supportive of that. You've got things like sequester that you're looking at. They're all budgetary things, but you don't have the people, and I'm talking more about the House, obviously. In the Senate, every senator has agriculture in their state. But today, you have fewer and fewer people that represent ag districts. In Iowa, we have at least two districts where you wouldn't have to know anything, and some of them don't, about agriculture.
But it's still valid to the state, but because they're looking at it from a district perspective, it doesn't resonate with them.
When they think about agriculture, they're thinking about how many jobs are going to be lost or gained at John Deere. The farmers are buying. The numbers of farmers obviously are down, but certainly people who have any kind of understanding of agriculture is greatly diminished. And you've got people in districts. There was anybody from Kansas here, but the big first district in Kansas, Pat Roberts' old district, Jerry Moran's district, you've got someone representing them that has voted against agriculture, production agriculture, consistently. And they're more concerned about some of these outside groups than they are about their constituents.
And what is your advice to people in agriculture or people who are trying to influence this if this, in fact, is the new reality?
Make your voices heard. And then this group here can have an enormous impact as far as not just talking to your producers out there, because most of those people understand the challenges we have, but to also get that message out to the general public, the unbelievable job that a small number of people do to produce the food fiber that we need in this country. But we've got to reach out past our own clique that we have in agriculture. And also, we have to be consistent. If there's one thing, and I think I mentioned it, but when somebody comes in the office once and tells you something, that's fine. It's not a priority. That message has got to be repeated and repeated and repeated. The fact that the squeaky wheel gets the grease is very true in agriculture, in Congress, especially on the subject of agriculture.
We've talked a lot here about how you tell the story more persuasively or compellingly. So tell us what part of the story would have impact on policymakers and legislators? What is it that would resonate with someone who hasn't actually operated or been involved in food production?
A lot of the jobs in Iowa are directly related to agriculture.
So you've got to make it an economic
issue for them to understand the ramifications of some of the policy changes that are being considered, to understand what the bureaucracies are doing and how important it is for Congress to actually function. I know it's a shocking, you don't use the two words together, but the fact of the matter is it used to work
better.
it was tough. It's always, you know, our founding fathers set up a system that was always going to be really hard to get stuff done. But it shouldn't be impossible. And in the past 5-6 years, whatever, the budget process has totally broken down. The way we rein in these agencies is through prohibition of funding for activities in EPA or wherever. It's almost impossible to get something like that done and signed into law today because the process never goes through a cycle. The Senate did not pass one appropriation bill last year.
It's shocking.
So how do you ever go to conference with something that doesn't exist? You can't do it.
Let's take the few minutes we've got. Questions right over on the side. We'll come to the front.
Sorry. Congressman, with sign-up obviously lagging into the farm bill, I would ask this. Mr. Roberts seemed to suggest more farmers leaning toward ARC than PLC. If that happens to be a pattern, what does that tell us about the cost of this bill, and does that run us into hot water?
Well, it's going to cost more money. The fact of the matter is we cannot reopen the farm bill. Because you're going to talk also not only that about also nutrition programs. You want to start the whole fight again. And the divide that we have, I don't know how we ever get another farm bill passed.
Really?
With the coalition that broke up last time, we separated nutrition out from farm policy. If you reopen that again, I think the whole thing blows up and you've got a real problem long term. Farmers, you know, contributed a great deal doing away with direct payments last time. I think we've got to let this thing work its way through, see what works, what doesn't, and then consider that going forward. But I think it's going to be extraordinarily difficult in the future to get a farm bill passed.
Next question, up in front and then over to the right.
Especially if we reopen again now.
Yeah, real quick, Congressman. In California, where we represent, We have our state representatives, and I think this could be the same with U.S. representatives in the state. Our state representatives from the rural ag areas, and in California, that's a $45 billion market, farm gate value. They are reaching out to their urban representatives. They're asking, please come to my district. Let me show you around. And all I asked you, they reciprocate.
Right.
And most of the time when they bring those urban representatives to the rural areas, there's a huge shift in the attitude regarding farming. And then they've got someone on their side, and they're different parties. What's the value of doing that, reaching out to the other side and bringing them in?
I think there's great value in doing that. I tried to do that with several members, you know, coming into Iowa. I do think that they're still going to go back home and represent their districts or as best they can. If you're in Manhattan or Harlem or someplace in New York City, food comes off the shelf. You have no idea where it came from. There's no farmer out there. They think it's manufactured someplace. So there's a total disconnect. And what you're talking about educationally would be very, very positive. But they're still going to go home and represent their districts, which is they like to think of cheap food. I think the thing that's going to shock them is if, in fact, a lot of these policies they're talking about putting in place and new regulations raise the price of food dramatically, then I think you're going to see them scream and say, what happened? And maybe then we'll have more support. But right now, we've had a total abundance of cheap food. So there's no problem in their minds, and their constituents are just happy as can be. That's not the issue.
Over here.
We've been too successful sometimes. We really have.
Congressman, you just said, I'm David Sparks, Allen Media. You just said resoundingly and emphatically, GMO foods are safe.
Mm-hmm.
I have done countless numbers of stories, PhDs, physicians, GMO foods are safe. I frequent a coffee shop, which I think is a reflection of the other side of the argument, and regularly there's a guy in there with his laptop and no GMOs, they are not safe. And what I'm asking is, Is there a significant body of science that supports that argument? I haven't seen it.
No.
Well, there's a significant body of science that supports that it is not safe, is your question.
Is there a significant body of science that says GMOs are the next Andromeda strain?
No. No. But the point you make, you Google GMO, and you get all these horror stories. You don't get anybody telling the story about the positive effect and what it does for feeding the world. Even the European Union scientists agree GMOs are safe, but the governments use it as a non-tariff trade barrier. I mean, you've got people that have rejected food in Africa with countries starving because it's GMO.
Right.
It's insane. Why we let that happen, I don't know. But it's, you know, Norman Borlaug talked about using every technology possible that's out there and the feeding a hungry world and saving. That's why he was credited with saving 1 billion people, because he modified genetically wheat, basically. That's what
one
it's
last
about.
Question in the back. I'm sorry, there are others. We'll let you huddle when we go out, but one last question for now.
Congressman, my question to you is, as a young producer that's trying to grow an operation, do I continue to grow my operation? Do I continue to go into further and further debt to expand my operation? Or with the uncertainty in Washington, should I sit back and be content with what I have?
Whatever makes you happy.
That's a very political answer.
No, in general, the situation in agriculture is way different than it was with the collapse back in the early 80s. It's much more equity, there's much more cash, there's the not leverage near to the point. I would take into consideration with any expansion the fact that interest rates are going to be higher, that the costs are going to remain high, and that market prices are going to be at current level or probably lower in the next 10 years. So you have to sit down. Every operation is different. The dynamics of what you do would be different than your neighbor because of your situation. So you'd have to go through and figure out what the potential is for the future. But I'm a farmer. I'm an optimist. It's always going to get better. The prices are always going to come back. Everything's going to be good again. Does that happen? I don't know. Someday it will. Are you going to be able to survive till that day?
Do you encourage young people to go into farming?
Absolutely. And that's, if you can find a way to do it today, the high cost of land and rents and equipment without someone financing them is almost impossible, or it is impossible.
I wish we had more time because you raised so many issues that are so front and center, but maybe let you...
I just didn't have the answers, though, for it. That's
yeah, well, that's, you know, the good thing about being the journalist is you just have to have the questions. You're the one who's supposed to have the answer. But I would, since we have so many agricultural journalists in the room, I might let you, since you're now out of Congress and you can do this, let you play assignment editor for a minute. If you were assigning a Bureau of Ag journalists today, what would you want to see reported, exposed, conveyed to the public, policymakers, others?
I think the success story of agriculture is missing in the storyline, that people have to understand that farmers want to make a profit, but they love taking care of land, which is their greatest asset. They love the idea of producing something, of growing thing. They're natural at it. I think today, and farmers are extraordinarily especially when times are good. They don't ever want to tell the story to anybody because, you know, someone will think they've got another dollar in money. It's like you go up to Northwest Iowa and get two Hollanders voting, you know, trying to buy a piece of land up there, and there's no limit. That's where you get $22,000 an acre land, because I don't need it, but I'm not going to let him have it. You know, that's the attitude. But we don't tell our story, and we don't make it clear to policymakers, again, going back, the impact that has on the future There's nothing that doesn't come from either mining or from agriculture. Eventually, that's the whole basis of wealth. And to tell our story and what an important part, while there's fewer people every day in agriculture, the important role that they play. And it's a difficult thing to get through to a lot of people, especially in Congress, where you've got more urbanization going on all the time.
Well, I want to thank you. You happy to be retired now? Is this a good
thing? I went from a constituency of 750,000 to one.
And that would be?
And it'd be Kathy, my wife.
Okay. Well, thank you for your service to the country, and thank you for being here today, and thank you for your views. I'm not sure they're the cheeriest way to end the day, but
it's reality.
It's the reality. Yeah. Congressman, thank you very much.
Thank you. Great effort.
All right. So, don't go anywhere yet, because what I have next as we go to break are very important instructions about the fun part, which is dinner, entertainment, music, and free samples. So we've reached the end of day one, obviously, and you'll have about an hour and a half or so to visit with one another, complete interviews, ask questions, give us suggestions if you have any. We'd very much like to hear that. Here's what takes place in the rest of the evening here. So at 7:15, if you join us in the North Building, room 120D, this should be on your program, but make note, at the Phoenix Convention Center. And over dinner, we'll be introducing our Young Farmer Sustainability and Produce Innovation Award winners. We'll also toast the first 10 years of the Ag Issues Forum. So it sounds like a couple good reasons for some good toasts, and I'll be raising my glass to Beth Roden, who is behind the whole thing. So, Beth, here's to you and all our other friends. Around 8:30, you'll get the music and the entertainment will begin with Eric Paisley. He's the accomplished songwriter, as you know, written a bunch of number one hit songs for Jake Owen and Rascal Flatts and others. He's a very charismatic performer and great vocalist. And his debut album, its lead single, Friday Night, reached number one. So it should be a lot of fun and high energy. Anyway, take some time between now and 7:15 to wrap up. Also, a quick reminder that the program tomorrow will begin at 8 in the morning. So breakfast is served from 6:30 to 8 a.m. when we will begin. And I hope you enjoyed the day as much as I did, and that you'll enjoy the evening as much as one another will. So we'll see you there. Thanks, guys.